This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's Election Day. The frenetic campaigning and the blizzard of TV ads are finally winding up. And once you've voted, there's not a lot left to do but sit around and wait for the results. So while we're in the eye of this political storm, we thought we'd take this opportunity to step back from electoral politics and reflect on the moment. We're a nation at war, and whoever wins today, that's unlikely to change anytime soon. Race, the eternal issue of American politics, is no longer discussed as black and white, but white, black, and brown. Religion plays an increasing role at work and in the culture wars. Scientific and technological breakthroughs change and challenge us in ways we never imagined. To help us define this moment in time, we'll talk this hour with scholars and thinkers from different disciplines, and we want to hear from you. Is this a moment of great significance in your area of expertise or interest? Or do you have a question for one of our guests? We'll be talking with a military historian, an expert on race and culture, an ethicist, and a scientist. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We begin with classicist and military historian Victor Davis Hanson, now a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's with us from the studios of member station KVPR in Fresno, California. And Victor, it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
We always read and hear about all of the technological developments in warfare, smart bombs, a digital connectivity, a high tech. Yet we find ourselves in a conflict now where infantry fight insurgents, sometimes house to house. Has war really changed all that much?
Well, superficially it has, but war is like water. Its essence is unchanging, and the delivery system, the pump, if you will, throughout the ages changes with technology. But generally, the West, and particularly the United States now, has conventional military superiority, and it even knows how to fight asymmetrical wars, whether it's the use of commandos or indigenous troops or offering political freedom and settlements or closing borders. But what's new, I think, in the delivery system is a globalized instant communication in which people all over the world can watch a battlefield without editorialization by the reporter, or with it, even worse perhaps. And it's almost as if a soldier in today's postmodern world must not only not be killed, but if he kills somebody, it can be a de facto condemnation of war itself. So in a postmodern, affluent, very secure citizenry in the West, people are not sure that war is any longer an answer to solving any type of dispute.
So the technology you're saying that's most significant is the technology of observation, television, satellite telephones, that sort of thing.
I think so. If a person's in the street and he shoots an RPG at an American Humvee, he may do as much damage by dying, being shot by an American Marine on global television without the circumstances of what he was trying to do being known, than if he actually hit the Humvee. Very few people in the world are going to say, was he trying to shoot a school builder or a power restorer? But rather they're going to ask, why did he have to die at all? So the old idea of war, that you convince an opponent to change a particular position through the use of force, is under debate now. Because we in our leisure, our security, really don't think that the rules of the Enlightenment don't apply everywhere in the world, that we don't really want to go back to the primordial world and settle things by force.
Yeah, if you read Roman history, and you've read a lot more of it than I have for sure, but Caesar, for example, fighting the Gauls, could afford to be ruthless. He could force them to defend something, a guerrilla kind of war. He could force them to defend something because they knew that once he breached the walls, every man, woman, and child inside would be killed.
Yeah, you think that after 9/11, I can understand dispute about Iraq, but there was even dispute about Afghanistan. We forget that now. And that was the largest precursor to any American war in our history, 3,000 people being killed in our soil. But we don't know what the exact number of casualties are that questions the value or the utility or the facility of war in the United States, whether it's 1,000 American dead, 2,000, 3,000. Our enemies think we're approaching that critical number, but we do know that it's much less than it was in Vietnam, much less than Korea, and a lot less than World War II or World War I. And that's what I think enemies understand, that if they get to that critical number, then a lot of Americans are going to think in a way that perhaps their grandparents wouldn't, that the war is counterproductive.
And so that the so-called Vietnam syndrome that we heard so much about after 1975, the fall of Saigon, the reluctance to use force, the reluctance to take casualties, we saw it demonstrated in Lebanon and Somalia and other places, that still applies?
I think maybe not so much. I mean, I'm not sure the American people have changed, but their view of themselves, their media, the entertainment has changed. We have a lot of elite cultural critics that are very influential. It's almost as if 40 years ago our parents, yours and mine, worried that if they intervened overseas, they were threatened with a nuclear deterrence from either China or Russia. If we intervene overseas, there's no nuclear threat anymore, but there is a threat that people in Europe might come down really hard at us in a very influential global media. And that seems to have almost the same level of deterrence, at least among a lot of people in the United States, than the old idea of 7,000 nukes pointed at us.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's still a lot of nuclear weapons out there, but I get your point.
Yeah, it's very strange, but I'm not sure that the average person, maybe between the East and West Coast, has changed that much, but the way what he reads, what he sees, what he hears is giving him a very different message about the nature of war than his grandfather heard in 1940 or 35.
Interestingly, that same piece of video distributed around the world can have very different effects in different places. The message received can be different, but I wonder, you say we're learning perhaps the rules of the Enlightenment now apply globally. Is that a bad thing?
No, it's not at all. It's just that as we see more democracies than ever, any time in the history of the world, and democracies are less likely, A, to fight one another, and B, they're more able to adjudicate problems internally without violence, we sometimes think that capitalism, increased global affluence, democracy is creating with it people who are all on the same pages. But there's vast areas, specifically in the Middle East, where there's things like polygamy, gender apartheid, even slavery in some places, and no democracy. And it's hard to think that particular people who live under those economic and social and cultural assumptions and protocols are going to naturally want to settle their differences in the United Nations. And then the other factor, going back to Roman times, which is a theme in literature, that the more affluent, the more leisured, the more sophisticated and educated the West becomes, it becomes almost more smug in its arrogance that thinks that everybody thinks like it does, and it's too wise or too sophisticated to have to use physical violence or muscular strength to settle an issue.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. As we're speaking on a day many people believe will be a pivotal one in politics, we're asking whether it's a pivotal day or a pivotal moment in a lot of different fields. At the moment, we're talking with military historian and classicist Victor Davis Hanson. Among his more recent books, The Ripples of Battle. Let's get a caller on the line, and Chuck joins us from San Francisco.
Hi. I really feel that, to some extent, we've been fighting the wars of the last century in the 21st century, and that worries me a lot. I think there's been the war on terror gets a fair amount of rhetorical support, but when you think of the enemy in the war on terror as a diffuse network of low-profile individuals scattered around the globe, and we've been primarily using conventional military means to try and fight them, I think that we haven't really been prosecuting the modern asymmetrical war properly. Often there's kind of derogatory comments about a law enforcement type approach, but I think a military approach really is much less appropriate. And I also think that there's been a neglect of the public relations communications side of the war on terror as well. So I really think we got to get on the ball in addressing the modern threats in a more effective manner.
Victor?
Well, those are all sober and judicious comments, but I think we got to remember that terrorists don't eat and sleep in outer space. They have to have the network of state control, state support. We know basically the countries they operated out of. And then there's a matter of perception. If somebody had woken up on September 12th and said, within 3 years, the two worst regimes in the world, really, that have sponsored and abetted terrorists of all sorts, the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, will be gone. There'll be elections in one country, and first time in 5,000 years, and elections slated in January. And this will be at a tragic, but nevertheless, the cost of 1,000 dead. Our grandparents would not have believed that. But we have increased expectations that we can get it almost instantly right. As far as the other comment about conventional military power, I think we're using both. We're using counterinsurgency intelligence. And when you have people on donkeys with laptops guiding in GPSs in Afghanistan alongside people that are have been fighting them pretty much the same way for 300 years, it's a new type of war in some ways.
I think your first comment about state support for terrorism, I would beg to differ with that. I don't have any special knowledge of the subject. You know, I just read the paper and watch the news and listen to NPR like most people. But it seems to me that there was much too much of an emphasis on state sponsorship, because when you think about the sorts of resources the terrorists need to conduct the operations like the one on 9/11, it doesn't seem to me that state support is necessary, and that that's been something of a distraction. Even when you start to think about some of the WMD issues, it seems that in this technologically empowering age in which we live, I don't see that developing a lot of chemical or biological, or I hope not, but maybe a nuclear weapons necessarily require state support. So I think that has been a bit of a
red herring
direction.
Yeah, there you go.
Red herring, you could say.
Okay. Thanks, Chuck, for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Victor, did you want to respond to that?
Just momentarily, the destruction of the Taliban was a great blow to al-Qaeda, as Saddam Hussein's removal was from everybody who were sponsoring suicide bombers in Israel to people like Abu Abbas or Abu Nidal. We know where these places are. They're places like the Bekaa Valley, Syria, Iran. And the whole premise of terrorism is based on deniable culpability. A state doesn't want to be transparent in the ways that it harbors or promotes or subsidizes terrorism, whether that's Saudi Arabia or Syria.
What factors do you see changing the nature of warfare in the future?
I think what's going to happen, one or two things, is that I think we are going to be shocked out of our complacency as we were in 9/11, that we're going to come back to the idea that war really doesn't change, and that there's certain laws and they're immutable protocols, if you will, that the essence of war is winning. So if you go into Fallujah and you're going to go halfway in or a quarter way or a third way in and negotiate or worry about CNN or the global TV audience, you're forgetting one factor, that if you win, people will be with you, and if you don't, they won't. That's hard to convey to a sophisticated American electorate. But much of the anti-war fervor that we see today comes not before the war or right after the war, but only when the perception that the United States military was not on the offensive and not winning. Because in the dark hearts of us all, there's this sort of reptilian brain or reptilian feeling that we want to see success and we want to distance ourselves from failure. And we forget that sometimes as war becomes at least ostensibly more complex.
Victor Davis Hanson, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Victor Davis Hanson, a military historian, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, also a retired professor of classics at California State University in Fresno. He was with us from member station KVPR in Fresno, California. His recent books include Ripples of Battle. When we come back from a short break, we'll be speaking with Michael Eric Dyson about race and culture and this moment in history. We'd also like to hear from you. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Everybody keeps saying the 2004 presidential election is one of the most important in decades. It may very well be one of those decisive moments in politics, but just how historic is this moment culturally, ethically, scientifically? Remember, we're not talking about presidential politics, at least not today. We've been doing that for months now. It's time for the voters to decide. So we're using this moment to reflect on where we are. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN@npr.org. Joining us now is Michael Eric Dyson, a professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of many books, including Making Malcolm, The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X, and I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr. He's with us by phone from his office at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Always good to be here, Brother Neil.
Race is an eternal issue in American politics, the one issue that runs through, I guess, every presidential election in our history. Not much emphasized this time around.
No, I think that the ingenuity of certain forms of race is its adaptability. The DNA of both prejudice, bigotry, or at least racial sentiments that are negative, change over space and time. And if we use that metaphor as a kind of organic presence. And I think now there has been subterranean racial warfare being exercised in very subtle fashion, so to speak, so that debates about cultural issues and about ethical issues and about values issues are always racially signifying. They don't have to be racist in intent, but they have racial consequence. And I think in this particular election, as with many others, the way in which the Morse coding of race has occurred depends upon, that is your perception of it, depends upon where you stand and if you're a victim of that or if you are a person who actually helps to organize it. So I think we're in a very interesting time that shows the subtle preoccupation with race, but it's racial warfare by other means.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess an example in history would be during the 60s, a racial appeal might be disguised as a stand for states' rights.
Oh, absolutely right.
And how is that coding working today? Give me a for instance.
Well, you can talk about standards in education. You know, when all of the brouhaha generated by the culture wars and about multicultural education, one of the things we see it being, manifest, one area we see it being manifest now is the whole debate about standards in education, which usually means we can't have a dumbing down of the curriculum or a splitting of the canon, so to speak, by including authors, perspectives, viewpoints, philosophies, and dispositions that fall outside the range of what we would consider to be the traditional or standard curriculum, or the fact that for the last 25 years, when we've seen the increase of people of color, especially African Americans, Latinos, and others, as well as the influx of women, that the old standards that were said to be in place now have suddenly fallen precipitously. So when you hear that kind of language, you always know you've got at least a racial war, if not other kinds of war on your hands.
The other war we hear about, though, is culture war. Is that have that has, I guess, some racial connotations, but it seems to be broader than that.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, you're involved at that level with race, class, gender, sexual orientation, and the differences that have been generated, and some interesting internecine squabbles. For instance, within African American communities, one sees, especially during this election cycle, a kind of cultural issue and a religious issue, but with racial overtones. For instance, the debate about gay marriage is itself an index of the way in which race has been manipulated to put forth an agenda that has a cultural basis. And I think that the collusion of race and gender and certainly sexual orientation and class are quite interesting, is quite interesting in this time around.
Mm-hmm. Do you see these issues at a crossroads, in a continuum? What's happening?
Yeah, well, both of those will work, crossroads and continuum clashing, and metaphors that stack up against each other. I think that in one sense we're at a critical crossroads in American culture because we're trying to make up our minds whether or not we're going to be ultimately committed to the principles of justice for every human being on the face of the earth, or especially in our nation, even during difficult times, or especially during difficult times. In the post-9/11 war, world. The reality is that all forms of racial profiling have been unleashed. Arab brothers and sisters are under special scrutiny, and the issues of color are both magnified and marginalized. Magnified because we see now that issues of color have not disappeared but reassigned themselves in this debate over who's acceptable and who's not acceptable as an American, and marginalized in the sense that we feel somehow that now that we're dealing with this global terrorist threat, we no longer have preoccupations with petty issues like racial prejudice or discrimination when that is not the case. Mm-hmm. So I think we're at a critical crossroads in that sense, but it's a continuum also, Neil, I think, in the sense that America often fixes on its racial realities at a moment when it's under severe insecurity. And I think the nation is quite insecure, collectively speaking, right now. Where are we in a post 9/11 world? Do we know who our enemies are? And when you have those kind of witch hunts in the name of preserving the integrity of American democracy and the fabric of the nation, e pluribus unum, out of many one, we tend to, I think, stigmatize, scapegoat, and demonize. And that certainly has happened with African-American and other people during this time.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line. Jamie is with us from Mesa, Arizona.
Hi, Neil. Thank you. I love your show. And
I've actually
read your guest books, and they're wonderful. I'm glad you're on here because it's kind of, I grew up in a very liberal family. We actually grew up when I was a child until sixth grade in rural North Carolina, and we were Jewish. And my only friends actually were black because the little white children thought I killed Christ, whereas the black children thought I was a chosen person. So who would you be friends with? So it was really interesting because now I live in a too homogeneous society for my liking. I live in Mesa, Arizona. I'm a small business owner now. I used to be a scientist. I'm struggling. I feel that I'm being hypocritical because how did liberal get to be a bad word? How I consider myself a humanitarian, not, you know, if you want to call that liberal, but
sure.
So fundamental to our country. I even feel like I can't wear my carry button to work because I would alienate a lot of my clients. How did that happen if we're truly, you know, divided 50-50 in this election?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. I think, first of all, 50-50 in election represents only the people who tend to vote. So already you've self-selected down to a much more manageable and unfortunately smaller population of people. The demographics began to get squeezed there in a different way. Number two, what's interesting is that the shift in discourse has been so severely to the right that even the center now appears to be much more conservative than it was, say, even 15, 20 years ago. After all, the rise of neoliberalism in American society, of which Mr. Kerry is a part, along with Bill Clinton in the Democratic Party, means that some of the more historic concerns of liberals were marginalized, first of all, within the party itself, and then in the broader society. And thirdly, I think that we've got to do what the right has ingeniously done, seize the terms of debate and baptize them, forgive me for that religious reference, in the waters of our own experience, and allow them to reemerge in ways that we're willing to defend. And of course, it makes sense for you to make choices about whether or not to wear a carry button because of the possibility of alienating clients, but also to begin to educate people in the best sense of that term, to invite them into a conversation. We may share different politics and ideologies, but can we have a reasonable discussion without making the other person look like the second coming of the of Beelzebub if they happen to disagree with us?
And that could apply to somebody wearing a Bush button on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, too. Yeah.
Exactly, but not where I live. Isn't it fundamental to our country that quote unquote liberals? I mean, interesting that you brought up the religious overtones because I'm Christian now, by the way, but I don't even understand how quote unquote the conservatives are now who I think are ultra right. You're right. No one's liberal enough for me. But how did that even become supposedly more Christian or more ethnic when, you know, more ethical, I should say,
right.
when there's all these ties to big business, you know, the lowest part of our population in money and education are being hurt even more. How did that even become more ethical.
That's a great point. I'm afraid I won't have time to answer it all today, but if you hit me on my email at University of Pennsylvania, I'd love to continue that conversation. But let me say this, that what happened, and you put your finger on a huge pulse in American society, is that the conservative brothers and sisters in this country saw that if they were to seize the upper hand morally, they would have to be on the cutting edge of personal, existential, and ethical issues that they felt were being neglected in the broader broader liberal community. So that while liberals were concerned about social justice, the right wing and conservatives began to talk about family values. Now, the irony, of course, is that when you talk about justice, you're providing a space for American families to be treated justly, and it depends on whose family you're valuing. The questions I have about many of my conservative brothers and sisters is that they have a narrow range of people. But having said that, the ingenuity of the right and the conservatives has been the ability to associate themselves with the ethical center of American culture and to talk about issues of moral concern. And I think what progressives have to do is to reassert the value of religion. I'm a leftist myself, but I'm also an ordained Baptist minister, and I teach religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania. This alienates many people on the left who believe that you have to be a stalwart person who is, in one sense, very secular and not religiously inclined, for good reason to a certain degree. But at the same time, I think the progressives and those of us who consider ourselves leftists and liberals have to reassert the necessity of joining issues of value to issues of social justice.
Michael Eric Dyson, I'm going to have to say thank you to you and appreciate your time. Jamie, you hang on, because your question is absolutely perfect for our next guest, too. I want to hear her address it. And Michael Eric Dyson, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Eric Dyson, professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Among his books, I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr. Joining us now is Jean Bethke Elfstein, professor of social and political ethics at the University of Chicago, the author most recently of Democracy on Trial. She joins us from the studio at the campus on the University of Chicago. And thanks very much for being with us. And this question from Jamie seems to be right up your alley.
Mm-hmm. Well, indeed. The question about the role of religion in American civic or political life is a question that has, in fact, enlightened and vexed us and challenged us from the beginning of the American Republic. It is literally impossible to decipher American politics historically unless you look at the role that religion has played for good or for ill. And I think most of us who look at it think on balance it's been for good. That is, you cannot understand the anti-slavery movement, the abolitionist movement. You cannot understand debates about capital punishment. You cannot understand some of the contemporary debates are continuing travail over the abortion question, the issues that came up during the campaign about harvesting embryonic stem cells after you have first, of course, cloned embryos for research use. All of these speak to some very, very deep issues that religion addresses, and indeed it is religious belief and conviction from which most Americans derive their ethical and moral viewpoints. I should add, of course, that War and Peace raises a whole range of ethical questions, and that we have a centuries-old tradition in the West of thinking about those issues, about restraints on the use of force, but also the justification for the use of force in particular instances.
Jamie, I hope we've developed at least partially an answer to your question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. We're continuing to talk about this moment in time. Our guest at the moment, Jean Bethke Elfstein. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Obviously, you're talking about issues, war, peace, religion, justice, too, an ethical issue.
Indeed, indeed. Social justice questions have always been joined by persons with religious convictions. Indeed, there was a Monsignor during the years of the New Deal, Father John Ryan, who was sometimes called Father New Deal because he brought some of the imperatives from Catholic social thought to bear on thinking about what could or should be done at the time of the Great Depression to deal with the massive dislocation, unemployment, people thrown into, families thrown into disarray and so forth. Social justice, of course, is a contested question, and there are many who argue that the best way to relieve the poor, and they do this from a religious perspective, is to make certain that the benefits of a free market are extended to everyone without exception, and that that will do better at dealing with poverty than massive government programs. So believe me that when a religious person says, my religious beliefs tell me that I need to care about social justice or care about war or peace questions or care about a range of other things, you will not be able to predict simply from that statement what the person's public policy preferences are going to be. You can't do it because persons with deep religious convictions are arrayed variously. And I, for one, would be very loath to say, you disagree with me on this issue, and therefore you can't really be an authentic religious believer. Because as someone who herself comes out of the Christian tradition, I understand that the Sermon on the Mount is not a public policy statement. I mean, yeah. These are all issues that have to be interpreted.
Let's get another caller on the line. Mark is with us. Mark's calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mark.
I look at this right now as a crossroads in the battle between religionists and realists. And right now the Democratic Party seems to represent realists, and the Republican Party seems to represent religionists. And I find it a frightening prospect, because anytime religionists gain control, we have things like the Spanish Inquisition. We have things like Galileo being excommunicated because he dared to think that the Earth was not the center of the universe.
Well, Mark, how do you fit African-American churches into that?
Well, I think African-American churches are looking at it from a more Christian standpoint than the Republican Party. Yeah. I look at what goes on in the Republican Party, George Bush in particular, and he loves to cloak himself in the mantle of Christianity, but Jesus told us, by their actions you shall know them.
And that's what John Kerry has said.
Is anti-Christian. Yeah. I mean, I look at the Republicans
Mark, hold on a second, Mark. You're painting it in stark terms, and I just wanted to get a chance for Jean Bethke Elstein to respond.
Yes, of course. Well, I think that, dredging forth examples that go back to the Spanish Inquisition and so on are not terribly helpful to our present time and place. We live in a very different society, obviously, one that has been blessed from the beginning with freedom of religious exercise. That includes Catholics, since the references to the past were to the historic dominance of the Catholic Church in Europe at one point in time. And I'm sure that Mark believes that as well, shares that belief with me, that we extend this freedom of religious exercise to all of our citizens. Now, on this ostensible divide between the religionists and the realists, I would just say I don't know how that holds up, given that, in fact, some 85% of the American population self-identifies as Christian, and I dare say that neither of the parties consists of 85% of the American population. So you have people who, with religious convictions on both sides of the political divide, and historically there has been a great tradition of Christian realism, represented in the 20th century most ably by Reinhold Niebuhr, the great public theologian. So I don't think that division works very well. Doesn't help us to understand what's going on.
Professor Elstein, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure, Neil.
Jean Bethke Elstein at the University of Chicago, the author of Democracy on Trial. When we come back from a break, Ray Kurzweil will join us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ray Kurzweil joins us now. He's a scientist, inventor, and futurist, the author of many books. His latest, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever, which he co-authored with Terry Grossman. He's with us from member station WBUR in Boston. And thanks very much for being back with us on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, great to be here.
Scientifically speaking, what's significant about this moment?
Well, as an inventor, I've been tracking technology trends actually for several decades. It's kind of taken on a life of its own. I have a team of 10 people that helps me gather key measures of different scientific and technical trends. And what we've noticed is that the price performance, the overall effectiveness of information technologies, is doubling every year. Now, this is well known in the computer field, but it actually affects just about everything, In this book, for example, we talk about how it affects health and medicine. We're now in the early stages of a profound revolution called biotechnology, which is basically the intersection of information science and biology. And we're learning the information processes underlying disease and aging and how to overcome problems. To give you a dramatic example of the impact of this exponential growth, it took us 15 years to sequence the DNA of the HIV virus. Mm-hmm. And we sequenced the SARS virus in only 31 days, and that's one of the reasons we got it under control so quickly. Now, also in the research and testing pipeline are powerful new therapies that will enable us to make dramatic progress in combating diseases such as heart disease, as well as dramatically slow down and even reverse the processes underlying aging. I'll give you two quick examples. We have little software programs inside us. They're called genes, and these evolved tens of thousands of years ago when conditions were quite different. So, for example, one program called the fat insulin receptor gene says, hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season may not work out so well. Mm-hmm. And that's actually not a good program for today's world. So we'd like to turn that off and in some exciting research at the Jaldson Diabetes Center, knocking out this gene enabled mice to eat a lot and remain slim and actually get the health benefits of being slim. And there are several pharmaceutical companies working to bring that to human market. And we actually have a technology now to turn genes off called RNA interference, which can actually go inside the cell and turn off specific genes. And that's exciting because gene expression underlies almost every disease and aging process. Another exciting area is cell therapy, basically creating new healthy cells to rejuvenate our tissues and organs, basically replacing diseased or destroyed cells. This is obviously what stem cell research is targeted at, and
sure,
that's an important area that should get strong support. The real holy grail for cell therapy is something called transdifferentiation, in which you could create, for example, new heart cells or pancreatic islet cells from your own skin cells. I mean, what is the difference between a skin cell and a heart cell? They both have the same DNA. The difference comes back to gene expression. They have different genes expressed, and we're learning actually how to control that. Just in the last year, scientists actually turned human skin cells into other types of cells. And once perfected, you could take your own skin cells and create any type of cell in your body to rejuvenate them with DNA-corrected versions.
And, of course, because it's your own cell, it wouldn't be rejected. It wouldn't have those problems. But I just wanted to ask you, sometimes there's a feeling that the science and technology create as many problems as they seem to be solving. For example, the incredible reduction in cost of communications bandwidth, one thing that's resulted in is outsourcing of a lot of jobs.
That's actually not so much a problem. I mean, we have greatly increased the productivity of work. We've gone from $30 an hour as the value of an hour of labor 50 years ago to $150 today, which has really produced the tremendous gains in wealth that we've had in the economic growth. But it is becoming a world community. I mean, the World Wide Web is making it really into one market, and we have to remain competitive in what will be a world market. There's really no way to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. How is are all these developments? I mean, they're going to change economies. They're going to change the way we live our lives, our very understanding of what life is, the 40 and 20.
I think, and that is really the main thought behind our book. I mean, our subtitle is Live Long Enough to Live Forever, and the whole idea is about two-thirds of the book is a practical how-to guide to apply today's knowledge to slow down disease and aging processes, which you can really do a lot more than people realize, so that we can be in good health when these more radical life-extending and life-enhancing technologies become available. So we call it a bridge to a bridge to a bridge. Today's knowledge will be a bridge to the full flowering of the biotechnology revolution. That will bring us to the nanotechnology revolution, where we can actually go beyond biology. And that will lead to radical life extension and rethinking the nature of human life. But I will say that it is the nature of human beings that we seek to go beyond our limitations. I mean, I don't define human beings as inherently we're not defined by our limitations. We're really defined by the fact that we seek to go beyond our limitations.
Okay. Before people flood us with emails on my calculations, 310. 310 is what I meant to say, not whatever it was I said. Let's get a caller on the line. Steve is with us. He's been very patient in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well.
Well, I just want to talk about the innovation in used oil re-refining technology and how this might impact the oil markets and energy policy in the future, or how it might positively be, you know, able to influence energy policy in this country.
So this is a development you see at a decisive moment, Steve?
Yeah, right now there are half a dozen re-refining facilities in the United States, and there's a new facility in Portland, Oregon, the fifth of its kind in the world. It's a smaller scale. It's less than $5 million investment, and smaller scale than the existing facilities in the U.S.
Okay. Ray Kurzweil, is this something you're aware of?
Well, those technologies are sort of incremental improvements. I think we do see within a couple of decades some quite revolutionary energy technologies that can really enable us to, for example, turn sunlight very efficiently and very inexpensively into energy. If we actually converted a small fraction of 1% of the sunlight that falls on the Earth into energy, we could meet all of our needs. We then need to store it with fuel cells. This third revolution I was talking about, nanotechnology, where we can actually engineer things at the molecular level, will enable these very inexpensive, very effective and efficient fuel solar panels to create the energy, nano-engineered fuel cells to store the energy. It'll be very decentralized, which is actually safer than our highly centralized nuclear power plants and, you know, energy storage facilities. So there are some revolutionary energy technologies in the works. It'll take a couple of decades to get there.
Well, Ray Kurzweil, we wanted to thank you so much for your time. A couple of decades to get there? We may have another power failure pretty soon like we did a couple of summers ago.
Nanotechnology, which will have a dramatic impact on our health, energy, also help us to clean up the environment, is in its early stages also, but it'll reach its sort of full fruition in about two decades.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. I wish we had more time to talk to you. Ray Kurzweil joined us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston, Massachusetts. His latest book, co-authored with Terry Grossman, is called Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. And again, he was with us from Boston. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.